Welcome to Puro Politics, the political podcast of the San Antonio Express News. My name is Gilbert Garcia, Metro columnist, and I'm joined by
business editor and columnist Greg Jefferson,
columnist editorial board member Carrie Clack,
and we've got a special guest today. We've got Scott Huddleston, who does a great job of covering county government for us. And a few months ago, we had Scott on to talk about a rift over a rescue boat. Scott, I think at the time you described it as the most discussed boat in the history of San Antonio. And this was a rescue boat that Sheriff Javier Salazar wanted. And he was finding outside funding for it. But this was something that upset County Commissioner Trish DeBerry. Right. Because he was going outside the commissioner's court. There's kind of a new source of disagreement between the two of them that you covered last week. What's happening? Right.
Yeah, well, thank you for the introduction, Gilbert. You do recall the controversy over the boat, which started in April and just kind of snowballed over the summer. But that's still going on, and the sheriff is still going to come back probably with a request for the boat at some point. But the latest thing, the rift between Commissioner Trish DeBerry and Sheriff Javier Salazar is what I call the dueling consultants on the jail, because the sheriff had apparently committed to, you know, working with the commissioner's court to decide collectively with the court and with county staff who would be the best person to conduct a study on the jail and, you know, recommend solutions to some of the problems that they've been having with staff over time and crowding and those kinds of things. It seemed like they were all on the same page working together on that. But then the sheriff about 2 weeks ago called an impromptu virtual news conference and announced that he was going to hire a consultant out of Belton, Texas called Detain Inc. Mm-hmm. And it was a surprise to Commissioner DeBerry. I began reporting on that online as soon as he announced it. And I didn't even have to reach out to her or to the deputies union to get feedback. They both provided some blowback to that announcement. Mm-hmm. And the deputies union felt that it was not, the optics of it just wasn't right with the sheriff, you know, basically choosing his own consultant.
Sure.
And Commissioner DeBerry is basically saying the same thing. Commissioner's court was tomorrow expected to consider hiring its own consultant, which is American Correctional Consultants out of Southern Florida. And they were going to do that tomorrow, this week. But she moved it up a week because apparently she's in a hurry now to get their consultant hired. So you've got, you know, the sheriff's consultant who's been retained, not using taxpayer funds, but using the asset seizure forfeiture funds, mm-hmm. I think $50,000. And the commissioners have allocated right around $20,000 for the consultant from Florida. And so that's where we're at. We have two different consultants on the jail. In the overall scheme of things, maybe that's a good thing that there's another consultant that the sheriff did not choose just for the sake of optics. But, you know, there's been some testy and spicy exchanges between the commissioner and the sheriff, and that just continues.
It really seems like Commissioner DeBerry and Sheriff Salazar just did not hit it off right off the bat. It seems like. How much of this is just kind of like bad interpersonal relations? Is there any partisanship involved? I mean, she's the only commissioner who is a Republican. He's obviously a Democrat. Is that part of what's creating this friction?
Well, you could try to break it down and look at it as partisan politics. You could say that maybe there's a factor of COVID fatigue, and also getting on a personal level, these leaders are human beings, and both the sheriff and Commissioner DeBerry have lost their mothers recently, and they're still in some process of grieving, I would imagine. But it could be that their personalities are so similar. They're two alpha politicians and they're both very, you know, high functioning professionals. You know, the sheriff is very high energy and he, you know, explains things explicitly and, you know, dots every I and crosses every T. And Commissioner DeBerry, I've seen her carry on two conversations simultaneously in a social situation. So, I mean, it could be that they're the two alphas in the room, you know, that could lend to clashing. Mm-hmm.
Scott, great reporting. And also in that, I want to kind of, Greg kind of asked the question that I was going to ask too, just wondering what was the source of this conflict, but I thought your answer was well, including the fact that both of them have recently lost their mothers. But where does this go? When are we expected to get both of these reports? And what's the best possible outcome with these reports?
It's hard to predict what's going to happen, but I do believe that the sheriff expects his consultant, Detain Inc., to come up with some kind of work product in the next couple of months, probably in the form of a draft report that will be tweaked. I know that the commissioners had wanted to see if that consultant would work with their consultant. And, you know, I'm not sure, maybe you guys have some feelings about this, but is that really the best course if they're trying to be independent of each other and if they're trying to have a consultant pass the test? But I think that hopefully they'll have some constructive ideas. One of the things that might be a looming possibility, though, is we may have to deal with the issue of, do we need a new jail? Mm-hmm. And that was, I think it's a 1987 structure, but they completed what they call the South Tower just a couple of years ago. So, you know, I don't know if we need a new jail or not, if it's already obsolete based on what jail standards are today.
Mm-hmm. One thing that I was wondering about, too, is that the sheriff and his pushback to the response he got from Commissioner DeBerry has been to say that suggesting that she's trying to privatize the jail. And which I wonder what your thoughts are on that. If you think there's anything to that, and if that was her goal, I mean, what exactly would that mean in practical terms?
Yeah, I don't think that she's said that explicitly, mm-hmm. but remember that she replaced Kevin Wolf, who was a Republican on the court, and he had the same kinds of exchanges heated with the sheriff. Mm-hmm. And so he would sometimes suggest that apparently there was once a time when the commissioners ran the jail. I believe that might've been in the 70s or 80s when the county mm-hmm. ran the jail and it wasn't fully under the sheriff's purview. And he's Kevin, when he was in office, would suggest that, you know, if I were the sheriff, I would say, you know, hand it over to the commissioners and let them run it. Mm-hmm. But I don't know if Trish is willing to go that direction, and she's never explicitly said that it should be privatized. But once a sheriff hands it over to the county might decide, you know, we're not in the jail administration business. Maybe we should privatize it. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, you know, if that's really the best route or not. You know, certainly don't you run the risk of compromising services and care for profit when you privatize? I'm not sure.
Yeah. And the level of oversight, I think that would be a concern. Before we let you go, I have to ask you this, and I don't know if you have an answer for this, but when you mentioned the figures, you know, the sheriff's consultant is what, about 50,000 or close to that. The commissioner's, their consultant is like less than 20,000. What's the... It sounds like the sheriff either got a bad deal on that, or the commissioners they drive a better bargain. I mean, do you have any idea why there was such a disparity in the costs for the two consultants?
Right. Yeah. I don't, but it's hard to believe that they could get a product of much value for $20,000. I mean, they have to, you know, fly the guy over from Florida, first of all, you know, and I just don't think that they would get a whole lot of value for that. But maybe he's really brilliant. And I don't believe that he's actually done any consulting for jails in Texas.
Yeah.
In the longer term, you know, I don't know if they're going to continue butting heads, if that's really in their best interest, because, you know, I know that a lot of folks feel that, you know, Commissioner DeBerry goes too far in criticizing the sheriff. And, you know, she's a Republican. At some point, she's going to be seeking reelection, I suppose. And I don't know how well that sells with her base. But on the other hand, I've heard that some people feel like the sheriff is too dismissive of what the commissioner is telling him. And perhaps that it's because, you know, she's a woman. So I don't know, in the best interests of each of them, whether they, you know, butting heads like this is really the way forward.
Yeah. Well, Scott, thank you so much for joining us. And we really appreciate the insights you've given us on what's going on there with the county. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. It's always interesting.
I want to move on to another big story last week, which was the announcement from Paula Gold Williams, the president and CEO of CPS Energy, that she will be stepping down soon, like in early 2022. Obviously, the CPS Energy has had a lot of challenges in the last few months since Winter Storm Uri. That they're not alone among utilities in Texas having challenges, but they've had some major problems and been subjected to a lot of criticism. They're looking at the need, or they're going to approach the city for a 10% rate hike soon, which is going to be a very contentious issue. Greg, you wrote about her and her situation and probably about 4 months ago. And I think when you posted last week on Twitter, I was glad because I thought, you know, you pretty much kind of saw this coming. You had kind of a crystal ball on this whole thing.
Yeah. I mean, it was pretty clear. That was back in June. And it was pretty clear at this point that she probably wasn't going to make it through the end of the year. I mean, part of it was, you know, I think as you've pointed out in a couple of your columns, I mean, look, she and CPS faced unprecedented problems from the winter storm in February. And a lot of it had to do with the composition of the Texas power market. I mean, you know, the rolling outages in San Antonio, which didn't roll very far, they kind of just hung around and just, yeah, you know, kept us in the dark for hours and days on end.
Part of the problem. I mean,
yeah, we'll just say super slow rolling power outages. Most of that had to do with ERCOT. And these, you know, mandates coming down from the state level. However, I mean, you know, there were clearly problems. You know, we had a number of power plants under CPS control that went offline because they just weren't prepared for, you know, very long-term freezes. There were miscommunications with SAWS that exacerbated the problems. There was poor communication between CPS Energy and its customers. And at the end of it, you had a lot of very raw, very angry ratepayers, and that just did not dissipate. It's, you know, and you could talk to any city council member. They would consistently hear from their constituents about, you know, that week and what CPS did and what CPS didn't do. Some of it, you know, some of the critiques were fair, some were not. But, you know, like there is a big component of Paula Gold Williams' job, any CEO of CPS Energy, that's political in nature. I mean, it is a city-owned utility. And, you know, politics and public reaction just consumed her, I think.
Now, just one, do you think that she would have survived if there had not been the freeze, or were there other things already going on?
Yeah, I mean, that's a remarkable thing about this. You know, before the storm, I mean, I don't think anybody ever said that Paula Gold Williams was a visionary CEO. Like she wasn't a transformational executive for the utility, but she was more than competent. I mean, you know, she managed finances and operations in such a way that they didn't have to go to city council for a rate increase. The last time they did so was in 2013. The rate increase kicked in 2014, and there's been nothing since then. Mm-hmm. I mean, with the city's population growth, like that was, you know, they were always going to ask for a rate increase this year, even before the winter storm and all of the charges that piled up from that. But I think she managed it very well. The environmental activists in town, they had a lot of complaints about her. They thought that, she lacked transparency. She didn't share enough information, particularly on the Spruce coal-fired plant and, you know, how quickly and how much it would cost to, you know, take it offline, to basically to decommission it ahead of schedule. Yet, CPS is clearly moving in the direction of more clean energy. And I don't know that activists are ever going to be happy with the CEO.
Well, and the thing too is that the Spruce 2 plant and also the South Texas nuclear project, I mean, these were things that were really put in play well before she took over. Obviously, handled criticism since she's been there in charge, that's fair. But obviously, these were things that predated her, and she kind of inherited all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Right. Absolutely. I mean, I would say though that a crisis really it sheds a lot of light on your skill as an executive, right? And I think. With the promotion of Fred Bonniewell to chief operating officer back in June and kind of the outflow of a lot of, fairly talented executives, all of that speaks to her ability to, kind of maintain the integrity of the organization. Like a really good CEO will ensure that, that she's got a strong bench of senior executives. I don't think that happened here. Like, I think that is one of Paula Gold Williams' failings. She's not done a really good job at nurturing and bringing up talent to the top level of CPS Energy. We're seeing that now. I mean, this afternoon, the trustees of CPS Energy will meet. They'll talk about, the executive search and, maybe they will, name an interim CEO, or maybe they'll talk about the timing of that. But it's pretty clear to me that they don't have a lot of, like, there's no executive at CPS right now that is like an obvious favorite.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, Carrie, I was curious to get your thoughts, not only on who you would maybe, what type of person you'd like to see succeed her there, but also, there are like two schools of thought on this rate hike, which CPS Energy and Paula Gold Williams have described as something that is like essential for their fiscal solvency going forward. And one school of thought is that now with her leaving, it's going to, the trustees are going to be really resistant or they're going to question whether to go forward to this rate hike or approve it. Another argument that I've heard is that city council members who might have been unwilling to give the rate hike to Paula Gold Williams, given everything that's happened in the last few months, when with a new person in there, they might be much more willing to do it. I mean, I'm curious what your thoughts are about the politics of this rate hike, which has been talked about so much.
I've heard the same thing you've heard, Gilbert, with regards to the latter, that with her still there, it was more unlikely the council would vote for the rate increase. But maybe under new leadership, they would be. Now, whether or not that 10% will also be at that one leap of 10% and maybe not phased in is another question. But I do think that just because the optics of everything that Greg described, that it would have been difficult with all the issues going on to convince city council folks to vote for a 10% rate increase.
I think, it's also worth pointing out that, two CPS trustees told us last week that, look, given the situation now, like they're not going to vote for a rate increase anytime soon. They didn't go so far as to say, we're just going to wait for a new CEO, because who knows how long that could take. I mean, remember how long it took to replace Doyle Beneby? It was a very long process.
Almost a year. Yeah.
Yeah. And, Paula was the interim CEO in that time. I mean, I think CPS as an institution would be in really serious trouble if they had to wait a year for a rate increase. We're talking about some huge, I mean, they've got huge bills. I mean, yeah. you know, they've got, you know, they've already said, okay, of the billion dollars in expenses we racked up during the winter storm, okay, about 425 million, I think somewhere in the ballpark, that's legitimate. We're contesting the rest in court. You don't know how it's going to play out in court. I mean, it could be that, you know,
a whole $1 billion. Yeah,
exactly. Wow. And on top of that, you've got over $100 million in past due bills. That's also a huge deal. I mean, you know, CPS is in financial crisis right now.
Aren't we also looking at like higher costs for natural gas going forward, like going into next year and so on?
Oh, yeah. I mean, higher costs are hitting CPS all around. I mean, not only is natural gas going to be more expensive than it had been before the storm, and this has nothing to do with the storm, this is a global phenomenon.
Right.
But you've also got, you know, simple building materials. Everything's going up. Like all of the stuff they use to, you know, make repairs at their power plants, to put up power lines, it's all more expensive.
Yeah. Well, the last thing I want to talk about is U.S. District 35, which is a seat that was created a decade ago when we came out of the redistricting process and new seats were added in Texas. And this was kind of an opportunity district for San Antonio. It's a district that runs up the I-35 corridor from San Antonio up to Austin. And there's a new opportunity for San Antonio to possibly have a representative there, because for the last 10 years, there's been an Austin congressman, Lloyd Doggett, who is now moving to the newly created District 37, which is really in his backyard. There's been some tinkering with the map, and, you know, we don't know what lawsuits how that might affect things. But as of now, there's a slight plurality of votes in San Antonio. I mean, I think what I'm kind of hearing is people sort of think because Hayes County voters might vote the way Austin voters would. If you add up Travis County and Hayes in a Democratic primary, an Austin-based candidate like Greg Kassar, who's a one of the Austin candidates or potential candidates in this race, might have an advantage over San Antonio candidate. But we've got Trey Martinez Fisher from San Antonio looking into this. There is the potential for San Antonio having a new seat here. Carrie, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about this because 10 years ago, we almost had a battle for the ages. We had Joaquin Castro, state representative at the time, rising star in Texas politics. He's planning to run in District 35 against Lloyd Doggett, the sort of old guard Austin liberal, and the race was playing out for a while, and then you had lawsuits and questions about the maps, and then Charlie Gonzalez stepped aside in U.S. District 20, Joaquin Castro moved there, and a collision was avoided. But you kind of had a close up view of that. What are your recollections of that race, and what are you looking forward to this time around?
We could have had two big races. Mm-hmm. The first one would have been Joaquin against Castro against Doggett, which would have just torn apart Bexar County and Austin liberals and Democrats, because that's yeah. where it was headed. But then the day after Thanksgiving. Charlie Gonzalez announced that he was resigning. He was going to retire. He called Joaquin. And I mean, that night we were at campaign headquarters and Joaquin and Julian and Christian Archie were calling all of the presumptive candidates who might have been interested in jumping in to run in District 20, and basically just saying, okay, I'm moving out of 35 and I'm going to go into 20. Yeah. Because Joaquin already had a full-fledged campaign with about $300,000 in the bank, no one got in.
Yeah.
But if not for Joaquin already having a campaign going, you could have had maybe Leticia and Jose.
I hadn't thought about that.
Carlos yeah. Uresti would have been the race that we may see in 35 in this upcoming year. Could reflect what we could have had in 2012, which, you know, personally, I'm glad we didn't have in 2012.
Now, the thing that that Doggett had to, and to his credit, Doggett, he had experience doing this because they were always gerrymandering him. So he'd have to, if he had to go down to the valley or whatever, wherever, some other new area, he was pretty good at working it and sort of building support in that, in some community that he had no history in. And he did that in San Antonio. But what I wonder, so because of what happened, Joaquin Castro getting, moving out of there, Doggett didn't really have a fight. But this time we are. And I think what I'm curious about is to get your take on, you know, if you're a San Antonio candidate, you've got to build bridges to Austin and the communities in between that you might not have right now. If you're an Austin candidate, you got to do the reverse. How do you do that? I mean, what kind of a challenge is that?
I think it is. I think it would be a challenge. I mean, you know, you go back again 10 years, if the 35 race had continued because Joaquin had been in the state legislature, there was already that relationship with Austin, which is why also I think that, you know, someone like a Trey Martinez Fisher, a member of the Bexar County delegation who's already has a relationship in Austin would have an advantage over somebody who's not in the legislature right now. But it also, you know, back in 2012, because it was just a two-man race, would have been a two-man race between Doggett and Castro. But now, because you don't have this formidable incumbent like a Doggett, it does concern me that Austin may have the advantage going into the 2022 election.
Yeah, I think, if Trey Martinez, if it comes down to a race between Trey Martinez Fisher and Greg Kassar in Austin this seat, I think Trey would have to, and I'm sure he would be planning to make inroads into Hayes and Travis County. Like, he needs to do that. He needs to, behave as Lloyd Doggett. when we had this new map, I was covering it at the time for Plaza de Armas, a news website at the time. And every time I turned around, there was Lloyd Doggett. He suddenly went from being this guy whose name I had seen in a lot of news stories to there he is every day. It's like I memorized his face. Trey Martinez Fisher is going to have to do some of that. I mean, he's not the retail politician that Lloyd Doggett is. Like, Doggett is a master of that.
He really is.
He's very good at glad handing. He's very personable with community leaders and constituents. He knows how to do it. And Trey's going to have to do some of that. On the flip side, expect to see Greg Kassar hanging out in downtown San Antonio,
And he's really interesting too, because he will already have some support. I mean, among the sort of Bernie Sanders, AOC, crowd who are really big fans of them. Yeah. I mean, he's already kind of somewhat of a hero, to really progressive, particularly young Democrats. So
Trey does what, he'll have a little bit of advantage because of the whole, Democratic legislatures, mm-hmm. Leaving the session and going to Washington Trey got a lot of airtime on MSNBC and raised his name and profile to a level that no one else getting into this race will probably have for what it's worth.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, man, that's going to be one to watch. So we'll wrap things up there. Thanks, Greg and Carrie, and thanks to Scott Huddleston for joining us and for everybody listening.
Go Astros.
Go Astros. <That's right. laughs>
I knew we couldn't get out of this without Astros.
thanks for doing that, Carrie. So everybody listening, take care, and we'll be back next week. Thanks.
Thank you.